Patrick, do you want to bring us up to speed on that, and then we'll call up a few people to explain some of them?
Madam Chair, House Bill 2929, we heard first at our meeting in Sisters on the 11th of April. It allows for the transfer of landowner preference tags for hunting deer or elk to be transferred to any person a landowner's choosing. The committee had previously received the Dash 1 amendment. I understand we just received Dash 2 amendments, and I believe Phil Donovan will be coming up to speak to those amendments.
Great, thank you. Phil, do you want to come forward? Is it Steve? Yeah.
I ask Steve Bassman from the Farm Bureau to join us as well.
You sure can. For the record, what we want you to do is explain what these amendments, how this would change the bill from what we heard at the hearing in Sisters.
Terrific. Thank you, Chair Smith, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Phil Donovan. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Guides and Packers Association. And at the first hearing, we used that opportunity to highlight the need for more flexibility in the current landowner preference tag program. As you heard, many landowners receive landowner preference tags, but don't always have the ability, for a variety of reasons, to use all of those tags. We also shared at that hearing a significant challenge facing Oregon's outfitters, and that's the lack of certainty in booking high-value hunting trips that help employ Oregonians under the current allocation system at ODF&W. And for many small businesses, this can be devastating. So allowing landowner preference tags to be transferred gives outfitters additional opportunities to secure a hunt, and by increasing landowner preference tags and their transferability, we also achieve an objective of giving landowners more flexibility. To the amendments, we had the Dash 1 amendments drafted up and then decided that the Dash 2 amendments were a better direction. And what we're basically seeking is a slight increase in transferability. The proposed Dash 2 amendments would increase the cap of transferability on landowner preference tags closer to 50%. Currently, it's about 20% transferability. So the Dash 2 amendments would modestly increase the number of tags that are transferable as follows. Basically, for a smaller landowner, if that landowner received one preference tag, two, or three, the Dash 2 amendments would basically maintain the current law as written. If a landowner receives four or five tags, two of those tags may be transferred, which would be an increase of one tag that may be transferred. If a landowner receives six or seven tags, three of those tags may be transferred. Currently, those people would currently receive only two. So again, just an increase of one transferable tag. If a landowner receives eight or nine tags, four of those tags may be transferred. Again, a modest increase of just one tag over the current law. And then finally, if the landowner receives 10 tags, five of those tags may be so used. This would be an increase of two tags. So again, fairly modest amendment. Anyways, with me today is Steve Mathers, who's president of the Oregon Guides and Packers Association, an outfitter out of Central Oregon. Wanted to give him an opportunity to share some thoughts about this.
Hi, welcome, Chair and representatives. My name is Steve Mathers. This would give us a, you know, this would sunset in 2010. It gives us a time to look at the program, see how it's affected by this modest increase, and then we'd have an idea what's going to happen. And ODF&W had some concerns about issuing too many tags, so I think this would take care of their concerns, and we can see where we are at that point.
Also with me is Katie Fast, the Oregon Farm Bureau, who's been supportive. But I'll close for the Oregon Guides Packers, and if there's any questions about the amendments, we'd be pleased to try and field those.
Are there any questions of Phil or Steve?
Phil? Thank you, Madam Chair.
Early.
So just to make sure that we understand this, you're also not only changing the number of tags that may be transferred, but you're also restoring the fact that we're only talking about the antlerless animals and that aspect as well.
Maintaining the status quo, Representative Burley.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Katie?
Yes. Yes,
thank you. Good morning, Chair Smith and members of the committee. For the record, Katie Fast with the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. We are in support of the Dash 2s. The landowner preference program is an essential program for our members throughout the state. Currently, our members are facing about $100 million annually in damage from deer and elk populations to their crops, pasture land, and hay fields. The Dash 2s make improvements to the program. It is not the full improvements we'd like to see from the landowner community, but a little baby steps are important, so we'll support the Dash 2s.
Thank you. Any questions for Katie? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair.
I don't see any questions. What I want to do is, since we just got the Dash 2 amendments, to set this over to Friday for our work session.
Understand.
Thank you. I'll close the work session. House Bill 2920. And we have already moved House Bill 3082. It was on the schedule because we have the 48-hour notice, just so if anybody knows. We've already moved out, so we'll go now to House Bill 3125. I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3125. Patrick?
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 3125 directs vector control districts and county courts to use integrated county courts. To use integrated pest management methods. It imposes a civil penalty of $250 per day against landowners who fail to eradicate vector habitats. It imposes a civil penalty for expenses when a vector control agency or county enters a plot of land to eradicate vector habitat, posing a public health emergency. It authorizes the Department of Human Services to provide matching funds with a vector control district for disease surveillance, allows for compensation for expenses incurred by trustees for attending trainings and educational conferences, declares an emergency, and would take effect upon passage.
Thank you. Could we move that laptop over to the side because we have people coming up to testify? I think if you just put the lid down, it would be... I think we have Chris Worth and Ron Montgomery. Do you want to come forward together? And we have Amanda. We have three. Thank you. Thank you very much. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Smith, members of the committee. My name is Amanda Rich, and I represent the Special Districts Association of Oregon. I'm just here to introduce my experts on this issue. With me today are Ron Montgomery, who is the district manager of West Umatilla Vector Control District. And so he's come all the way from the great city of Hermiston to be here before you today. And also with me today, this is Chris Worth, who is the director of Multnomah County Health and their vector control program, and he is also the president of the Oregon Vector Control Association, which is an association that represents all entities that are working toward vector control in the state of Oregon. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to these guys. They're the experts on this issue, and we appreciate you hearing from us.
Thank you. Which one of you want to go first?
I will.
Okay. For the record, you need to state your name. And
good morning. My name is Ron Montgomery. Good morning, Madam Chairman and distinguished members of the committee. I'm the manager of the West Umatilla Vector Control District, serving a 525-square-mile portion of Umatilla County, Oregon. I'd like to thank Chairperson Smith for her leadership in holding this important hearing regarding House Bill 3125 and Oregon's response to West Nile virus and the challenges in addressing its spread and impact on our state's public health. In 1971, the electors of Umatilla County created by ballot referendum the West Umatilla Vector Control District. Supported by property taxes, this program continues to provide relief from mosquitoes and protection from mosquito-borne diseases. For nearly 35 years, this program has provided this vital public health service. The introduction and spread of West Nile virus in the United States has reawakened an appreciation of mosquitoes as vectors of disease. 16,000 human cases of West Nile virus have been recorded nationally since 1999, with 620 fatalities. On September 10, 2004, Oregon recorded its first case of West Nile virus. With this unwelcome arrival now a reality, the West Umatilla Vector Control District is asking for support of House Bill 3125 to help promote a proactive approach and response to mosquitoes and mosquito-borne illnesses, replacing a more traditional reactive approach. I would like to testify to three specific proposals included in House Bill 3125. First, the inclusion of integrated pest management as defined in ORS 634.650. Adding integrated pest management to ORS 452 would mandate that all vector control activities in Oregon performed by either a vector control district or a county court would be based on a coordinated decision-making process and action process that uses the most appropriate pest control methods and a strategy in an environmentally and economically sound manner to meet agency pest management objectives. Now, most long-established vector control districts in Oregon currently use IPM methods, but inclusion of this language as proposed would provide essential guidance for new vector control districts. And just as a point of reference, there are approximately five new districts being formed this year to address West Nile virus. Ultimately, the promotion of integrated pest management methodologies for vector control in Oregon should reduce the amount of insecticide used for vector control throughout Oregon. Second, the creation of a tiered penalty system that will allow a vector control district or county court to work with landowners to identify vector habitats and address modification or elimination of these habitats. And I'd like to just interject a real kind of a real life situation and how this plays out and why this is important to a vector control district. Umatilla County is a very much an agricultural county. That agriculture is made possible because of irrigation. Imagine a 500-acre cattle pasture that's irrigated with a series of pipes that run through the land. And these pipes are leaking all summer long, and about 25 acres in the low-lying areas of the pasture are continually filling up with stagnant water. Currently, vector control districts can enter that land, spray pesticides, and pick up the bill for that, and that's how it typically happens. An inspection takes place, and the application is made. But we cannot encourage the landowner to fix the pipe. We have no authority to ask that landowner to address that vector habitat. So we're asking for this authority in this bill. The creation of a tiered penalty system will give vector control districts and county courts another integrated pest management tool to use. Ultimately, a tiered penalty system should reduce the amount of pesticides used for vector control activities in Oregon. And third, the ability of a vector control district to compensate a trustee up to $100 per year to attend conferences that provide training and education to carry out their duties as a trustee. All vector control districts in Oregon are governed by a 5-member volunteer board of trustees. These individuals are charged with overseeing the operations of the district and their ability to attend local, state, and regional training conferences that update them on the latest and greatest in vector control will better prepare them to carry out their objectives for their local program. Finally, I would just like to stress that environmental stewardship is a core value of the West Umatilla Vector Control District. Since 1971, this program has met the challenges of protecting the health of the public using an integrated mosquito management toolbox that includes habitat management, source reduction, biological control, and chemical control. The introduction of West Nile virus into Oregon will bring many challenges to all public health officials, including vector control districts. We must be prepared to accept and meet these challenges. Our citizens deserve no less. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Roebling?
My question is that I worry that this could put landowners at risk from two in both of the areas. You come into an area, I'm talking mostly Western Oregon, Southern Western Oregon, where we get a fair amount of rain, and we get standing water, and that water creates an environment that is defined now as a wetland. And then the district comes in and says, you know, if you fill that in, you would eradicate the problems of having these pests. And so the landowner decides, okay, I'll fill it in, and then finds out that he was supposed to have received and gotten a permit to fill in a wetland. And so now he's getting fined for having disturbed a wetland. And so if he doesn't do yours, he gets fined. If he does yours, he gets fined. And I am concerned about that. Any suggestions?
Madam Chair and Representative Roebling, that's a real good question. I would think that in most circumstances, the vector habitats that this law would address would be artificial habitats, more temporary stagnant water. Certainly, wetlands would not. I would not foresee any vector control district filling in wetlands to control mosquitoes. There are much easier approaches. Habitat management, introducing natural predators into that wetland would be a more logical approach to address the mosquito situation if it was producing mosquitoes. Filling in a wetland is a radical approach, and I don't believe that that would be the intent of a vector control district. I've not known any to have ever done that or suggested it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, similar question, but let's go to the east side then, where we're not so much dealing with wetlands, but let's use your example of irrigation pipes that are leaking or whatever the case may be. And I too had some concerns when I read about the enforcement aspects of this. But before we get into that, I'd like to ask you specifically on page 2, line 16, one of the amendments is that you're deleting the existing law that says use funds of the district to assist irrigation districts, for example. Why? I mean, if everybody's paying through their property taxes into the vector control district and currently you're using those dollars to help carry out the mission, why are we deleting that in this particular line?
I believe the intent of that was to not subsidize irrigation districts from doing what they should already be doing, which is maintaining their irrigation ditches. Vector control, typically, in my district, I've been in the management position for 16 years. We've never had a request from an irrigation district to actually pay for ditches. We more get requests for technical expertise. So we felt that would be more appropriate to change this and to more meet the current conditions as they exist. But I believe the intent would be, I don't think it's appropriate for my district, the taxpayers that are paying for vector control, to then be to fund another public agency that's also receiving tax money to fix their ditches. I think that's an easy out for the irrigation districts. Although the goal is the same, to get the ditches fixed and to reduce the habitat.
Thank you. I think Representative Brooks, I was going to let Mr. Worth go ahead and feel free to answer it.
Sure. Thank you.
Quick follow-up.
Sure.
You just made mention it's not appropriate to use funds. Can you, as the representatives of the association, recall any situation under the present law where you had to or you funded repairs on irrigation districts?
I could speak specifically for Umatilla County, and I'm not aware of any situation where we have.
And if I may respond, my name is Chris Worth, Oregon Vector Control Association and Multnomah County Manager of our local vector health program. One distinction is the consortium of those agencies that are part of the statewide Oregon Vector Control Association. Some are special districts, which do levy tax funds as their funding base. Some also includes other local public health departments, which are using a general fund base. So there's a variety of different kinds of streams of funding that may interplay in going back to the question originally proposed by Representative Burley of why you would may not pay for an irrigation ditch project or so forth. So in that case, what you would really be using would be using general fund money, and in that case, that doesn't seem like an appropriate use for that.
Follow up, Madam Chair?
Yes.
Back to the specific question, can you recall where a district that you represent used its funds to repair irrigation districts?
My apologies for not directly answering that question originally. So in answer to that, Chair Smith and for Representative Boquist, no. For Multnomah County, I cannot recall.
Thanks.
Thank you.
May I?
I guess I wanted him to testify, and then we could have questions for the whole panel.
Okay, thank you.
I haven't given Worth an opportunity. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. So my name is Christopher Worth, and as I previously mentioned, I am president of the Oregon Vector Control Association and manager of Multnomah County Vector Control. I have provided written testimony, so I will try to keep my oral testimony brief in fairness to this process. On September 10th, 2004, Oregon experienced its first case of West Nile virus. House Bill 3125 85 positively supports the numerous statewide local public health agencies and vector districts that are actively preparing and managing vector activities, including West Nile virus, in the following three ways. In one way, it directly directs those agencies performing those vector control activities to use an integrated pest management approach in controlling vectors, including mosquitoes. Integrated pest management is simply a multiple-step approach that additionally considers the ecology, the human health risks, and the risks to wildlife and the environment. In light of also considering other methods such as habitat management, water management, and pesticide use as necessary. Two, it adds to the tool of that integrated pest management toolbox by creating a tiered penalty system to be used as appropriate, because really prevention is the key in eliminating mosquito-borne disease or vector-borne disease. And a really good common example of that is if there's a pile of tires somewhere in the community, by working to get rid of that tire pile before mosquitoes hatch into the flying, biting adults, which transmit disease, that far less would reduce the amount of disease present in the community. It's the immature forms of mosquitoes, or mosquitoes when they're young, in their aquatic life cycle. If you can control them at that point, you are reducing the population in a much more manageable level. And three, the ORS 452, which House Bill 3125 addresses, has not been reviewed in approximately 20 years, and the language of House Bill 3125 would far better reflect the more modern approaches of mosquito control and vector control and how those activities are done, which would allow for much more of a transparency to the vectors, to the public that the vectors serve, and to facilitate and improved in educational outreach. So thank you. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to take those at the time, and I'd like to thank the committee for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Mr. Worth. Representative Worthley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess what I'm having a little bit of difficulty with trying to reconcile what you're suggesting here, and I want to go back to, again, line 16 on page 2, where you're taking out the fact that you're using vector control district funds when you work cooperatively with irrigation, drainage districts, etc. And that amendment would be to paragraph 8 of 452.110. But then in section 3, it says that under 452.110, all work performed shall be paid for by the control district. So the amendment's really not consistent in and of itself. But then you also add in section 3 that the work performed shall be paid for by the control district, except, and you're adding, when the district enters land to eradicate a vector habitat under sections 10 and 11, which are new parts to the act, and this is where you go onto someone's property and take care of the problem. And what I'm trying to reconcile is, right now, without any changes, if I'm a landowner and I've got a problem and I'm paying taxes into the vector control district, you can come on my land right now and take care of the problem. So why are we changing this now to where we're going to have a penalty for this when I'm already paying my taxes to the district and you can come out and take care of the problem? Why are we changing this around? What's not working?
Chair Smith, Representative Burley, I'd like to address to get a response for you at one part of your question, which is that in Multnomah County, I can't speak directly to using funds because we don't operate in a special district operation. However, as an example of this, if there is a land with a water aquatic area that is producing mosquitoes, through negotiations, you may want to be able to provide doing some different types of activities, which may be cost more, have better results, and by being able to share that with the landowner and negotiate that, they're still going to be maintaining their land in a way that's appropriate for them. It may cost a little more, and likewise, it's still considering the public health of the community by interacting with the vector agency. So in that case, through those negotiations and through levying with a tiered penalty system, there is some negotiation in how that control of that vector is done on that specific property.
Can I answer your question, sort of? Representative
Okay, Roblin? Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chris, I want to ask you kind of the same question because you're over here on the other side of the mountain. And definition of wetlands comes up fairly quickly in our properties, and especially if we have a rainy spring, the perfect kind of spring that will cause our vector problem creates another problem in that if you find a wetland plant, it becomes a wetland. And so these neighborhoods and other things, and all of a sudden we find a big influx of mosquitoes, and you come out and say, boy, you know, if this was filled in, if this was taken care of in this backyard and so on. And so the person in goodwill goes and does that, and then the neighbor next door says, you know, that was the wetland you just filled in, and calls the federal government or whatever, and they come in and investigate and say, there were wetland plants here, you just filled in a wetland. How do we make sure those kind of things don't happen? I don't want to put people in that position.
Sure. So, Chair Smith, Representative Roblin, a real-life example of that would be, for example, there's a variety of agencies through Naturescaping and a variety of other programs that require sort of a multiple-step approach in managing their lands. And one example of that is the encouragement of beavers and beaver dams. Beaver dams do create standing water. They do contribute to increasing the risk of mosquito-borne disease. Standing water is there. And so in a circumstance like that, we're not seeking to remove the beaver, or fill in the wetland. What we would be seeking is some kind of negotiated method or methods to be able to more frequently control that area for mosquitoes, use maybe vegetation management. I mean, there's multiple steps approach, and it is on a case-by-case scenario. But in that case, we're not looking to fill the lands. We're just looking at that ability to balance the needs of land managers and balance the needs of public health.
Yes.
And I understand that because that's where there's a fair amount of water. But I'm talking about places where, you know, even in people's backyards, they get standing water in certain places. And because things grow so rapidly here, a lot of times they become wetlands fairly quickly. And it's not going to be a beaver dam. It's not going to be that kind of stuff. And the truth is, the landowner would probably like to fill that in and have a yard that drains better. But to do so creates a violation at times. And I get concerned about if you came in and said, boy, we're having a mosquito infestation in this neighborhood. And we go and look, and everybody's backyard has standing water. And you say, well, let's fill that in. And so they go forward because that's what they would like to do, too. And then it comes back to get them that they just created a problem for themselves and they're in court again. So are there any safeguards to make sure that in doing this, you know, we don't get people caught in the middle?
Chair Smith, Representative Roblin, I think that my understanding of the language of House Bill 3125 has those safeguards in because it's an integrated pest management program, meaning that you're using education, you're working with them, and this isn't really about the heavy hand of government coming into somebody's backyard where there may be water collecting. It's really just one of many negotiation tools to be able to engage and interact persons of the community. And from my personal experience, so I found that most people, when approached with this situation, they're very interested in abating it on their own for a variety of reasons.
Thank you. Representative Berkowitz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have three questions, actually fairly short. So
okay.
I'd just like to know the number of districts total in the state, how they each of them developed their five-year plan, and then if you could just give the committee some idea of how you define significant change.
Madam Chair, Representative Boquist, there are approximately 17 special vector control districts in the state of Oregon, and to the best of my knowledge, there are two county governments involved, Multnomah County and Washington County. I believe that's a total of 19 programs. The plan you're referring to is the pesticide use plan, which is submitted to the Oregon State Health Department and the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife for approval prior to pesticide applications. These plans are developed individually by each district. They consist of an explanation of what pesticides are planned for use, how they what criteria is determined or is used to determine that pesticide that is chosen, how it's to be applied, and how much of it will be applied in what circumstances. The plan also defines sensitive areas in the district and how those areas are addressed as well, and talks about monitoring for non-target impact on other organisms. The final part of your question, if you could refresh me, part three.
I follow up again. In any significant changes to that plan required that it to be resubmitted to the bureaucracy?
The mosquito control, we have not seen a new compound for mosquito control introduced for use in nearly 15 years. So a significant change, I believe, would specifically be a new pesticide introduced and registered for use for mosquito control. That's how I would define significant change in the plan.
May I add?
Yes.
Chair Smith and Representative Boquist, other examples of significant change could be if there's a new area that's defined as a sensitive habitat, which those sort of designations come up repetitively or routinely over a 10-year period. Anything which is part of that pesticide use plan would all be considered as a significant change as well.
Follow up, Madam Chair?
Yes.
Could you define routinely?
Chair Smith, Representative Boquist, it's really at the discretion of what's happening in our community. I mean, Department of State Lands is making wetland designations all the time. There are a variety of public agencies that are managing lands for a variety of ESA issues and other wildlife issues. So as they're making these changes, we're trying to follow along and assure that they're able to still meet their requirements while still meeting ours at public health.
Thank you. Representative
Berkley. Thank you. Just real quickly, and I think, Chris, you this yesterday, but just for the record, we passed a bill earlier, and I forget the bill number, but it dealt with adding homeowners associations to the list of entities that could contract with a vector control district, and this was specifically regarding the Sun River Homeowners Association. This, if this were to go into effect, would have no effect on that bill that we've already passed. Is that correct?
Yes, Chair Smith, Representative Burley. I would agree that there would be no effect, neutral effect. I would think that it would even synergize some of the activities that from my understanding that they're trying to do out in that location.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next we have B.J. Smith from Clarkson County. And I have Cherry Witt signed up too. When you've got somebody with you, B.J. You guys want to all come up? Thank you and good morning. PJ, you were first. Rebecca, you want to identify yourself?
Yes, I will, Madam Chair. I am BJ Smith. I am the Public and Government Relations Director for Clackamas County. And I do have with me today Bob Storer, who is from our Water and Environment Services Department. Our position on House Bill 3125, as written, is that we oppose it. And I want to talk about a specific provision that is the basis of our opposition. We come from a county where there is a vector control district, and as you may know, vector control districts have members that are appointed by the county commission, and there is a relationship between the county commission and the vector control district that is ongoing. Each year, an annual work plan is submitted to the county commission to review the work activities of the vector control district. The Board of County Commissioners has the ability to review what is in that work plan to make certain that it is reasonable in terms of, I think, the public health needs and the vector control needs of the citizens. So at the local level, we have a need to have some local coordination of decision making between the county government and the vector control government. If there are deficiencies found in an annual work plan, the county has the ability to extend an existing work plan and ask that those deficiencies be remedied. And we work through a process to do that. But ultimately, all of this needs to come together so that we have a plan that has a balanced risk to the public. The risk of applying pesticides needs to be balanced against the gain to the public and what we're doing with West Nile virus. That total work plan has to come together. It has to work. One of the comments I believe Representative Boquist just made is he referred to a five-year plan. And originally when we had just kind of an early introduction to the thinking behind this bill, it was remarked that there was a five-year work plan. And we were quite confused at that point in time because, as I said, we have an annual work plan requirement to make certain that comprehensively all of the elements of the vector control plan work. You do have a reference to something that is a pesticide use five-year review under the Department of Human Services here that is only looked at if the vector control agency makes a significant change in its program, then it would be reevaluated. Our concern is that the total program needs to be premised on a strong look annually at the plan by the county government to make certain that all of the planning works together to meet the needs, and that is particularly of concern to us as we look at West Nile virus. We have come from a period in our county where we didn't have a tax base. We had a we are looking at a major increase in what our next annual work plan is going to be like, and it is a struggle and a challenge to move forward with meeting the needs of West Nile, but it is also an opportunity to spend money well. We're concerned that the provisions of the bill could be inconsistent because of that section that has to do with the five-year opportunity for DHS to basically take a pass in looking at this unless there is a significant change. We're concerned that that could be inconsistent with the importance we put on the annual accountability of making certain that the entire program comes together. And I think that with that, I would ask Madam Chair and members of the committee if I could just have a staff person from another aspect of county government, not vector control, talk to you a little bit about why it's important that we have the opportunity to make certain that we have the comprehensive look at the entire program and that we've strengthened that as much as we can and not detracted from it.
Thank you, VJ. I'm going to have to limit testimony because we have so many people signed up on the next bill that I want to make sure we get ample opportunity to discuss it. So you've submitted written testimony. What would you like to add?
Good morning, Chair Smith, committee members. My name is Bob Storr. I'm an environmental policy specialist with Clackamas County Water Environment Services. I'm in charge of developing a response and compliance program to the ESA and working with our vector control district to formulate a plan. The coordination and communication is so important. To be successful, we really need all of our stakeholders and customers working together, all of our agencies. This is a really big concern of ours. The five-year review is something that we really have a problem with. There are specific changes, concerns that we have. I'll just list a few of them. But I also want to say, while the vector control districts need the flexibility to adapt their control strategies, we believe that the structure of the vector control law is set up so that counties as well as the vector control districts must address these challenges together. It's through the county that the vector control would have a primary connection to the public health officer, these other health professionals, and those of us who manage and control stormwater, water quality, and regulate sensitive areas. We believe the bill may result in less cooperation, miscommunication, and an uncoordinated response. A few of the questions I have... I won't go through all of them. In an emergency, it may not be possible to send out a warning notice to every affected landowner. It states that in the bill. But in addition to that, when notifying citizens and landowners, one should establish a radius around the vector habitat and not just notify one landowner. Eradication may not be an option. We really need to focus on control, and the eradication should focus on elimination of the public health vector, not just the habitat. And I would ask, what constitutes a serious health emergency, and who would declare this? There's other issues in terms of the MSDS and toxicity levels. The Department of Human Services currently has to review and approve a vector control program's pesticide use plan. We think local programs should be reviewed more frequently, as BJ said, than once every 5 years.
Okay.
I think with that, I'll cut it off, since you have the written testimony.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, what we really have said is that annual program is very important to us. And what we would not like to see is a legal commitment to a five-year plan review on a portion of the pesticide use management, which is re-reviewed only if there is a change.
Okay.
That's our
point. Thank you, Terry Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Terry Witt, Executive Director of Oregonians for Food and Shelter. First of all, OFS does support the empowerment of vector control districts to protect our citizens from vector-borne disease. I think particularly in light of the fact that we have seen five cases of West Nile virus last year, and we will likely see an explosion of cases in years two and three if Oregon follows history in states across the country. We also support the IPM strategy concept, which emphasizes prevention and early detection and treatment as opposed to simply trying to control afterwards. We do have some concerns about the language in Section 10. I think there potentially is some changes that are warranted. It uses the term vector habitat throughout Section 10, and I think many of those subsections within Section 10 really are more appropriately listed as the public health vector. In other words, the pest as opposed to the property or the condition that is creating the breeding of mosquitoes or whatever it may be. And I think, as Representative Roebeland pointed out, there are some things which are not or cannot be controlled unilaterally by the landowner or by an agency, such as fill and removal. Those types of activities require coordination with other agencies, and so you could conceivably be in a situation where a landowner is given an order to clean up or fill in an area and does not have the authority to accomplish that, or, quote, eradication of a habitat. So we have real concerns about, I think it's more terminology than it is anything else in Section 10. Section 11 on page 4 uses the term serious public health emergency, and that is not defined. And that gives the courts, in essence, the unilateral right to go in and immediately, in this case, deal with eradication of habitats and assessing civil penalties for the cost of eradication. Again, I think this is potentially a problem. If it's not defined, it could potentially be an abuse. The fines can be up to $250 per incident, which typically means per incident per day, could conceivably be quite hefty, particularly in light of the fact that maybe regarding a situation that the landowner has no control over. And last but not least, sections 10 and 12, which set up the criteria for or the authority to issue civil penalty. We believe that civil penalty is a tool that should be used very sparingly and should be reserved for recalcitrants and repeat offenders and not be part of a routine regulatory process. The way this is set up, I'm afraid that it would be used as part of a routine regulatory process as opposed to limit it to those situations that do warrant civil penalty for people that have ignored or continue to harbor these vector pests. Be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Quick question. Representative Sumner.
I was just wondering, in Section 10, it does have an elaborate process for mitigating mosquito. It goes all the way from providing notices to assistance with the et cetera, et cetera. How long is a life cycle of the mosquito larva. We're talking about days, aren't we?
Chair Smith, Representative Sumner, I am not an expert on the cycles of mosquitoes, but I would presume that you're probably correct that the life cycle is relatively quick. But I think they repeatedly breed over the summer, so it's not just a one shot deal.
So this is rather a cumbersome process to for a few days window.
Chair Smith, Representative Sumner, I think it's fairly cumbersome potentially, but I think one has to go back to on page 1 and 2, section 2, that is currently existing language, which gives the control district authority to enter any lands to eradicate the pest itself. What we're looking at here, the way this is written, is it gives them the authority to go in and eradicate the habitat. I think it's an extension from that perspective, at least the way it's currently drafted.
Got it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, panel. And I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3125. Thank you very much. Okay. What do I have to
do? Open a work session for introduction of the meeting.
I'm going to open a work session to adopt a committee measure. Representative Boquist, you pass it out.
Madam Chair, I move LC 3617 be introduced as a committee bill.
This is the bill that we had drafted, the wolf bill, that was the same as we did last week, and we have to do this as a procedural vote. So I have a motion to adopt LC 3617.
Yes, ma'am.
As adopted as a committee bill. Do I have any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Close order. Adopted. LC 3617. All right, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3046. Patrick, do you want to give us a little information on this?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, House Bill 3046 deals with the sending, possessing, receiving, and breeding of exotic animals. I believe all you have before you that's the operative thing for this meeting is the Dash 3 amendments, which were submitted by Representative Hess. He would be able to speak to those, okay. And I'm sure we'll have plenty of people to testify, so I will go ahead and defer.
All right. Thank you, Patrick. We do have plenty of people signed up, but Representative Hass, would you like to tell us what you want us to know about your bill?
thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, committee. I didn't come to this issue so much as it kind of came to me, or you might say it kind of crawled to me.
Okay.
Starts with the alligator story about 2 years ago in Beaverton, when some folks had purchased what looked like a fun little lizard, but was actually a baby alligator about 4 inches long, and before you know it, the alligator was 4 feet long, and it escaped one day. And terrified the neighbors in this little cul-de-sac in this part of Beaverton, and it was not kept. While these were good people, they were not people trained in this sort of thing. They didn't even know the gender, which made it more difficult for police and firefighters when they eventually did find him, and they trapped him a few days later. Unfortunately, no one was chomped or bitten. As a result of this, I started studying what happened, and I don't know why Beaverton seems to have these experiences, but they do. And I found out that even though Beaverton passed an even stronger ordinance to prevent this sort of thing, city ordinances are sometimes inconsistent and result in kind of a patchwork. In this case, once the animal was captured and after Beaverton passed its ordinance, they simply moved Al to a friend's house outside the city. This has a sad ending to it because after all of this commotion, Al died. And Al was far short of his average lifespan for alligators of 30 years. I'm not a scientist, but I know that a small bedroom in a suburban home of Beaverton is probably not the best place to raise alligators. Again, in Beaverton, just last month, federal agents raided a home where a woman was raising ocelots. And the truth is that these exotic animals are becoming more and more popular in our culture.
We have had law enforcement people tell us that they're particularly popular in the drug culture as signs of status. I just want to make sure and reiterate what Patrick said, that this bill has been basically deleted by the Dash 3 amendments, which changes existing law to put restrictions on future licenses. It still keeps this in the purview of our Department of Agriculture. There is a grandfather clause so that if someone owns one of these exotic animals now, they can keep that animal. It will not be taken away. I think one of the benefits of this is that gradually, I hope, the ODA will be phased out of this responsibility as the number of grandfathered permits decrease. Now, we have compromised and tried to accommodate many of the people and many of the government entities on this bill, and that's how we've sort of, if you will, for lack of a better phrase, watered down this bill to get to where we got to today. I still hear opposition here and there in emails, and for example, the biggest one I hear is this will only put this issue underground. And I remember when we were dealing with the cockfighting issue a couple of sessions ago, that was the argument then, that you won't get rid of cockfighting, it'll just go underground. Well, I mean, you could use that same logic to drugs. There are people who want to legalize drugs, and we're just putting it underground. Well, maybe so, but that I don't think that above ground is where we want this activity. So the basic problem we're trying to solve here is these animals, these exotic animals like tigers and crocodiles, cannot be domesticated by their very nature. And it's cruel to subject these animals to that, and it's also potentially very dangerous to have them in our society. So I'll finish with that. I know there's some people who have traveled a long way to be here, and we have some experts in this hearing who can answer any of the technical questions you have. I have some newspaper articles about Al the alligator and some other correspondence I can pass out to the committee.
So that would be great. Thank you, Representative Pass. We do have a number of people signed up to testify, and many... Okay.
If you just interject, just Representative Haas, am I correct? There is a federal permitting process somewhere out there.
Yes. Yeah, we'll hear more about that. And this Dash 3 has appropriate exemptions for that.
Thank you. She's sitting. Representative Haas, were you here to speak on this bill?
Yes, I am.
Okay. It would be all right, except we are very limited on time. We have to be on the floor at 11, and I have a number of people signed up. So please come forward if you'd like to.
My comments will be extremely brief.
Thank you very much. Everybody's will be.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Debbie Farr, State Representative for House District 14. I am in support of this bill. I'm a co-sponsor. I wanted to just share very briefly a story that is probably similar to other stories that you'll hear, but it happened 10 years ago. Thanksgiving Day, my son and his friend decided to hike through a big drain pipe that is near our home, and we thought that they were just hiking down around a canal, but they decided to be boys of 12, and they went through this big pipe, and they found what they thought was an alligator, and later was determined to probably be a caiman. And they ran home wild-eyed, and my husband went back looking for it, couldn't find it, but they found where it had made a nest. And in any case, animal control went the next week looking for it and found evidence that it had been there, but didn't find the caiman, and said, well, you know, it'll die, it's November, it's too cold for caimans, and, you know, this happens regularly. People will have a pet like this and find that they don't have the ability to care for it, and so then they'll let it loose and let it fend for itself. So my comments... or just that. I think that story speaks for itself, and I think that everyone needs to be a responsible pet owner, and I think that applies to owners of exotic animals as well.
Thank you very much. I'm going to try to... I'm going to have to time our testimony. I have Jesse Clark White first, Leslie Day, and it's Tiger Preservation. I'm going to bring you up in panels. Do you want to come up? You have about 2 minutes. Each, if you have some written testimony, that would be great.
Can I all three?
Yeah, sure.
I called the names. Mm-hmm. Jesse Clark White.
Chair Smith.
Yes.
Would you like me to give these?
You're right there.
It's okay.
I did. I said Jesse Clark White.
Who is?
Okay. Leslie Day. And Tiger Preservation,
yes.
Is that a name? That's not your name.
No.
Okay. Well, then you need to stay for her, but we'll go first with her.
Thank you. I will keep this brief. Chair Smith, members of the committee, my name is Jessie Clark White. I oppose this bill very strongly, as well as any other attempts to ban exotic animal ownership. I'm an exotic animal owner myself, and I'm an assistant to the Legal Affairs Director for the Feline Conservation Federation, which also opposes this bill. I want to clear up a misconception. Currently, any Oregonian who owns an exotic animal must have either an Oregon Department of Agriculture permit or a USDA permit. In order to qualify for these permits, you have to meet some pretty stringent requirements and undergo inspections. But of the two, the USDA permit is the strictest. A large segment of the Oregon exotic animal owning population operates under USDA permits. That includes myself. I just heard testimony, and I've been told that this bill, as amended, allows current licensees to keep their animals. I've read this bill very carefully and found that it allows current Oregon Department of Agriculture licensees to retain their permits and their animals. However, it creates an instant ban for USDA licensees except for research facilities. Research facilities are the only USDA licensees exempted. If this bill goes into effect, I would have to immediately get rid of my pet or give it away, kill it, or act as a criminal. And I'd just like to appeal to any animal lover here, ask you how you would feel facing that type of action. Another harmful effect that this bill would have would be to ban the breeding of threatened and endangered species. Many species owe their survival to private breeding programs. In fact, one of the country's most prominent snow leopard breeders is a USDA licensee in Oregon, and this bill would put him out of business and harm the future of that species.
Thank you. Your time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you. You can stay seated in case there's questions. Go
ahead.
I think we have, is it Lucky?
Leslie.
Leslie, I'm sorry.
Chair Smith, members of the committee, thank you for having me here. My name is Leslie Day, and I'm the founder and president of Chimps Incorporated in Bend, Oregon. It's a nonprofit sanctuary. We currently house 3 cats and 4 chimpanzees. Oh, it is up there. Okay. That is a picture of our sanctuary. I'm here to testify from the sanctuary point of view. Most of all of ours are ex-pets that have come to us from the entertainment industry, personal ownership. People can't handle them anymore. Cats and monkeys, primates, chimpanzees, they're born and they're cute. I also started out wanting one as a baby. And I decided to do a lot of research before I went into this, which so many people don't do any research. And I did a lot of research and found out that I didn't want to take a baby away from its mother. The ones that needed rescuing were the ones that were over 6 years of age that were too big to handle anymore. And they were either going to roadside zoos or laboratories or biomedical research and all that. They're very intelligent. And he did get all the locks undone. And this is the size of these chimpanzees, and they're huge. And they're behind bars for the rest of their lives because the humans put them there, and they didn't ask to be, from our selfishness, because we think they're cute and we think tigers are cute and all big cats, that they're unique. And I think I know I only have 2 minutes.
You've got about 8 seconds, actually.
It starts with education. I support the bill.
Okay.
It's horrible what's happening.
Thank you. Go ahead.
My name is Bonnie Ringo.
and I own the Tiger Preservation Center in Oregon. In the past 30 years of dedication to survival of captive wildlife, I've invested over $2 million of my personal money. I've incurred many personal sacrifices, which include my husband living and working away from the home most of our married life, to support the center. We currently maintain 21 tigers, lions, and leopards at a cost of over $60,000 per year. The money to maintain my facility does not come from any government grant or charitable donation, but rather out of my own pocket. The Tiger Preservation Center is one of several that maintain endangered species here in Oregon. Oregon now is recognized as having the largest white tiger exhibit on the West Coast. Not only does the Tiger Preservation Center boast this fact, but also houses the rarest color variations of tigers in the world. I have never had any situation threatening the health or safety of the public or myself in the last 30 years. In the event this bill is passed, it will destroy my entire business, which has been dedicated to the support of captive endangered species through international conservation. In 2002, the Tiger Preservation Center donated 5 tigers to Zion Wildlife Gardens in New Zealand. This was the first time New Zealand accepted tigers from the United States as permanent residences. This donation was for the purpose of conservation through the program of Global Tiger Patrol for preservation of wild tigers in India. Global Tiger is a non-profit Rathbone Trust. It is a registered charity based out of London dedicated to conservation of the wild tiger in India. The tigers which were sent from the Tiger Preservation Center are on a lifetime contract with GTP and ZWG, Zion Wildlife Gardens. This contract states that for the lifetime of the tigers, a percent of the viewing monies and education will go to support Global Tiger's endeavors of protection and conservation of tigers in the wild. To date, on report with Global Tiger and the U.S. Department of the Interior, over $10,000 have been given to Global Tiger Patrol from Zion Wildlife Gardens. United States and Canada have also pledged on lifetime contract with Global Tiger Patrol for funding through educational program of endangered species. Our captive population of endangered species is the best method to ensure survival of our critically endangered tigers in the wild through captive gene pool preservation.
Thank you. Can you submit that in writing to us?
Yes, I can. Am I done?
Yes.
Okay. Can I just add something?
Very quickly.
Very quickly. Without conservation in captive populations, we're going to lose our endangered species. So I am definitely in opposition to this bill.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Pamela.
And I am in agreement with everything Ms. Wingo just said.
Thank you. I think we got that. Marla O'Donnell from Deschutes. Scott Beckstead.
Madam Chair.
Yes?
Wanted to thank Ms. Day for coming all the way over from Bend. And
we have a lot of people from that far away.
And I think her center pretty much illustrates the need for something like this, is that these animals do look cute when they're young and resist.
Oh, sure, yeah. Thank you. Thank you. I have Scott and Jackie Beckstead. And Marlo O'Donnell, do you want to go? Go ahead.
Chair Smith, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Marla O'Donnell. I live in Redmond and currently provide safe housing for 2 capuchin primates. In addition, I do volunteer at Chimps Incorporated to help care for their exotics as well. I am a neutral position on this bill, although I feel that banning exotics will only encourage people to obtain the animal without permission, without guidance of authorities, and possibly promoting poor care and inadequate containment. I do feel that it's important to increase current requirements that may discourage impulse decisions on obtaining exotics. I believe that the current caging requirements need to be addressed, as well as steps towards licensing. Education is the key. Possible solutions may be to require 20 to 30 hours of hands-on experience with animals of like kind with licensed facilities, or possibly enforcing a 90-day waiting period before granting a license. Possibly requiring applicant to pass a test to ensure that they are knowledgeable on laws, responsibilities, health care, and specific needs of the animal before they make the long-term commitment to house and care for the animal. The recent occurrences in California regarding the escapes of primates and big cats only reinforces the need for their keepers to have safe caging conditions and an emergency response plan to keep both the animal and the public safe. In conclusion, it's important to note that in order for us to address the issues at hand, we need to start at the source, the profiting breeders. There's too many exotics in need of safe and adequate housing right now. So to me, it seems senseless to support or continue to allow the exotics being brought into the system. And I'm primarily talking about those that are not endangered. Thank you very much for allowing me to testify today.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Scott?
Chair Smith, members of the committee, my name is Scott Beckstead. Thank you for allowing me to speak on behalf in favor of the Dash 3 Amendment. I'm speaking to you today in my capacity as mayor of the city of Waldport. Waldport, because it's such a small town like many other small communities around the state, does not have the financial ability to pay for its own law enforcement. So we contract with the Lincoln County Sheriff's Office for what's called enhanced coverage from the sheriff's deputies. And we simply these deputies simply do not have the training, and most law enforcement officials do not have the training to deal with the problem of exotic animals. And over the past several years, I can think of at least two occasions where either within the city of Waldport or just outside of Waldport, there were situations where people had exotic animals. They had become neighbors were concerned about their health and safety. People were concerned about the animals' welfare. But law enforcement simply did not know what to do with them in the animal. Just basically continue to languish in misery. The neighbors continue to be concerned about their own health and safety until the people finally up and moved. So I think that that this Dash 3 Amendment is very much needed, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chairwoman and committee members, I'm Jackie Beckstead, and I am the Animal Services Officer in Lincoln County. And I thank you for the opportunity to come and give you our county's position on this, and it is definitely in favor of the Dash 3 amendments. We are looking for one uniform state law, a blanket law that covers the whole state. If it does not pass, our county will go ahead and make a county ordinance, but then we are looking at county to county, the rules changing and people moving from county to county, and we would just like it throughout the state. Also, as Mr. Beckstead added, that law enforcement is not adequately trained in exotics, nor are most animal control officers, and even though I've had some exotic training, there's no place to house them. In neglect places, even abandoned ones or ones that have escaped, there is no facility to put them, and then you're at a loss for a place for them. And as for the cruelty issue, obviously, as was said, they start out as little babies. They grow up. People don't have bad intentions. They're heartbroken. Then their animal is caged up for their safety, the neighbor's safety, or abandoned because then they don't know what to do with it. And then my last topic is a lot of veterinarians do not know how to deal in small communities with exotic animals. And the doctors, the physicians, a lot of them are not up on zoonotic diseases, and so that is another big issue. And I just thank you again for letting us be here to speak our mind, and we're definitely in favor of this.
Thank you very much. Thank you, panel. And I apologize to everyone. Obviously, we didn't know this many people were going to sign up, so I apologize for rushing everyone through. Nicole Peckett, or I'm sure she'll correct me. Robert Reeder. Redder and Damiana Merriweather. Thank you so much for coming. For the record, state your name.
Good morning. My name is Nicole Paquette, and I'm an attorney with the Animal Protection Institute. I also work on this issue nationally, and I assist various states across the country and localities with passing these laws. And we've successfully assisted Arkansas pass a bill prohibiting certain exotic species this year. I'd first like to thank the committee for allowing me to come.
The Dash 3 amendment will, as stated, prohibit future ownership of exotics. Now, what was misspoken earlier was that the exemption still exists with respect to the USDA license. It's not just a research facility. So the existing law exempts wildlife rehabilitation centers as well as all USDA licensed facilities in this state. So we are not amending that provision in this bill. The Animal Protection Institute does have a sanctuary where we rescue primates, so we're all too familiar with the problems of keeping these animals. State governments have taken the lead on addressing these issues. Oregon is one of 13 states that currently regulate the private possession, and the trend across the country is moving towards prohibiting these animals in private hands. 23 states to date have banned the private possession, and most recently New York passed a law that is similar to this bill, prohibiting all the species that are included in the Dash 3 amendment that took effect last year. There is very little federal oversight on the keeping of exotic pets. Specifically, the only law currently on the books is the Captive Wildlife Safety Act, which was passed in 2003, and essentially all that does is it prohibits the interstate transport of large cats from one state to the other. So if you lived here in Oregon, you cannot purchase a large cat from, say, Washington or from California. So we view HB 3046 as strengthening the federal law because it'll put into place future prohibition on this on the private possession of exotics. Okay. And I also can answer any questions. I've handed out a handout on a Q&A. I've gone into detail about some of the misnomers about exotic pet possession as a conservation argument. And I'm sure the zoo can probably speak a little bit more to that. Thank you.
My name is Robert Reeder. I'm a regional director for the Humane Society of the United States. I'm here representing our 106,000 Oregon members in support of this amendment. As a former police officer and a former humane investigator, I have seen the increase of ownership of exotic animals and the results of that from those who are ignorant to the issues surrounding the ownership of such animals as lions, tigers, alligators, caimans, and etc. It is frightening to know how easy it is to obtain one of these. Just this past week doing some research, I went to several websites and found that I could easily purchase by credit card over the internet hatchling alligators for $50, adult crocodiles running from $400 to $10,000, and dwarf caimans for $225. On those websites, you'll find disclaimers that require you to have a permit at the point of shipment, but you don't have to prove that permit ahead of time. It'll just be shipped to you. It's even more frightening to think that these animals may be in your neighborhood without anyone's knowledge until there's an unfortunate incident. Obviously, as animal advocates, we are interested in the welfare of the animals involved and the inhumane and cruel aspects of having these animals. But however, nothing is more important than the safety of our children and keeping them from injury and death. The capability and unpredictability found in the family of crocodilians makes them extremely dangerous and potentially life-threatening. Another website research brought me to the organization called the Crocodile Specialist Group. This is a worldwide network of biologists, wildlife managers, government officials, farmers, traders, tanners, fashion leaders, and private companies. You notice no humane societies, no animal rights organizations. A quote from their website: through the pet trade, various crocodilian species have become more widely available, yet there is virtually no information available on the internet or in published books on how to look after them in proper captivity and properly in captivity. Crocodilians, including caimans, are definitely not for beginners. In months, they grow considerably in size, and their temper usually gets worse with every day. They may be cute as hatchlings, but this does not last very long. They have incredibly powerful bites featuring many sharp teeth. And in conclusion on that quote, it is not surprising that many owners, frequently misinformed, desperate to sell the animals, end up giving them away or, worse, disposing of them in some manner that may be illegal, inhumane, or both. Someone else will touch on the health issues. I'll pass that over.
Your time is up, so thank you very much. And you can submit anything in writing that you'd like.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Damiana Merriweather, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Humane Society. Although our names are similar, we are not an affiliated organization with the Humane Society of the United States, but we are here in support of their efforts on this bill. The Oregon Humane Society is an independent, not-for-profit, providing shelter, placement, animal welfare enforcement in Oregon for over 130 years. And we are simply here to provide our support as one of the primary entities that goes out investigating reports of animal abuse and concerns about animal welfare. The addition of exotic breeds and the complications that come with the uniqueness of those animals simply makes that work harder and increases the demands. We think that this is an appropriate and reasonable limitation on the placement of really wild animals within personal settings. So we're here in support of the Dash Race. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, panel. I'm going to go to the people that came more than 100 miles, so I make sure I get everyone in. Robert Tenney, Mike Daly, Dave Hansen.
You're supposed to know.
Should I begin?
Oh.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Chairman Smith and members of the committee. My name is Bob Tenney. I am the director of West Coast Game Park Incorporated, which is the second oldest zoo in the state of Oregon, and also is the third largest zoo in the state of Oregon. We have worked with exotics for over 37 years. If this bill were to pass as written, as I understand it, because we are a private entity and not supported through either a nonprofit or a taxable contribution system, we would simply have to close shop. Now, I have 450 animals and birds. We don't have any alligators. Might make some. I don't know where alligators came in as far as reptiles. We do have tigers, lions, leopards, snow leopards, cougars, bears, and oh my. I feel that we contribute greatly to the income of our area, and I think I could gain great testimony and support of what the park does in attracting tourism. But I think that if they use a sensible approach, there is room for improvement. But if you're saying that we cannot breed, for one thing, we're licensed by USDI, and the only reason we're licensed as endangered species is because we have to breed. If we are not breeding, we will lose the permit. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's even been brought up. If the endangered species are not capable of reproducing in captivity, they're disappearing in the wild, and they are not recommended as a pet, quote unquote. We've never placed an animal for a pet basis.
Thank you. We're out of time. Thank you very much. Mike Daly.
Representative Smith, members of the committee. My name is Mike Daly. I'm a county commissioner in Deschutes County. My wife Darlene and I own a non-human primate, a small capuchin monkey. His name is Andy, and we've had him over 10 years. Darlene was not blessed with any children of her own, so Andy fills a very big void in both of our lives. He's as important to us as any human child and would be to any other couple. Darlene and I chose to obtain a permit from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which exempts us from the requirements of Oregon law. In many ways, the USDA permit is more restrictive than Oregon permits. It requires annual renewal and have an approved, complete, and up-to-date program of veterinary care form at our place of business, at our home. Also, every few months, we get a surprise visit from a USDA veterinarian who comes into our home to inspect our facilities. How much more regulation do we need in Oregon? The Humane Society of the United States is pushing to restructure Oregon's exotic regulations, as well as many other states in the United States. Even though they share the Humane Society name, they are not affiliated in any way with our local animal shelters. A review of the proposed changes in Oregon law reveals their intent is to prohibit breeding of exotic animals and ultimately ban the private ownership of exotic animals in Oregon. Oregon currently has laws on the books regulating exotic animals that work very well. They're fair, easy to understand, and have been successful in regulating exotic animal ownership in Oregon. A sentence in current Oregon law, ORS 609309, states, and I quote, "It is the policy of this state that regulation place no more burden upon the keepers of exotic animals than is required to accomplish the purposes expressed in this section." The proposed language in this new bill and its amendments deletes that sentence entirely from Oregon law. In closing, Oregon law is working well. We've had no emergencies in Oregon that would warrant changing anything. Remember the old saying, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. I want to thank you for our opportunity to testify here today, and I urge you all not to allow this bill to go forward.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen?
Yes. Representative Smith and panel. I'm Dave Hansen from Bend.
Our family, my wife, and our four children have been in the exotic animal business for 27 years. We are regulated by the Federal Department of Agriculture, the Department of Interior, and this Oregon state law. Because of the Department of Interior, we're licensed for the endangered species. We're the largest snow leopard breeder in the United States. We have been for several years. Our facilities, we breed on demand for the zoos and sometimes the movie industries. The federal inspectors, when they have stated that our compound is the nicest that they have ever seen. We have spent thousands of dollars on the proper housing and have done extensive research on the health, breeding, and behavior of the snow leopards. The major zoos have problem in raising the some of the species, like the snow leopard. For example, when the Portland Zoo had a pair of snow leopards and they bred their leopards, they've got two leopard kittens, snow leopard kittens. One got sick. They couldn't tranquilize it to inspect it. They were afraid the extra burden on it would kill it, so they let it go. And it died. Then its litter mate died, and the mother died. And at the same period of time, we had nine snow leopard born in our facilities. We presently have 36 born in our facilities.
Your time is up, Mr. Hansen.
Pardon?
Your time is up.
Oh, it's.
I know. That's terrible.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I think it's necessary to clarify that the reason there are not you don't see exemptions in the amendments or the bill is because the exemptions aren't changed. If a wildlife rehabilitation center is still exempt, a facility operated under a valid license issued by USDA is still exempt, and so I just want to make sure that you know that. You're testifying in contrast to what the intent of the bill is, and the original laws are not being changed in terms of exemptions. And Commissioner Dale, I just want to make sure you understand, too, the grandfather clause in this. You won't have to give up anything. Someone incorrectly stated that they believe that would, and that there is a grandfather clause. You won't have to give anything up.
Thank you, Representative.
But these animals cannot be taken out of the wild, and even that we're grandfathered in, when I die, someone has to take over producing these endangered species because it has been proven that the zoos cannot do it. And the private breeders have been successful. I'll put my breeding facility against any zoo or help any zoo in the United States.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much. Everybody's being so patient. Danny Maron Oliver and Harry Oliver. Buffy?
Hello.
Okay, go ahead.
Hi.
Welcome.
Thank you, Representative Smith, for having me here and for all of you taking the time to listen to us. A lot of things have been said already, and I'm just trying to see what I can say that won't be redundant. I am against House Bill
3.
Excuse me?
You have to say your name.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
My name is Danny Maron, M-A-R-O-N, Oliver.
Thank you.
You're welcome. I am against House Bill 3046 and its amendments. I belong to the American Society of Primatologists. I'm currently writing an article for them. I belong to the Simian Society of America. It's a 47-year-old organization. I was formerly on their board of directors. I am currently a president for them. I belong to the Jane Goodall Institute. I belong to many organizations that take care of animals, the IPPL, the International Primate Society also. I am also trained in epidemiology. I'm on the CDC clinicians list, and right now I'm going to be working on getting my CIC, which makes me certified in infection control. As a registered nurse, I teach infection control. I'm very, very much up on it. I own 4 New World monkeys, and I can only speak for the New Worlds because that's my area of expertise.
So why would you be opposed to this bill? Why don't you just tell us that?
Excuse me?
Tell us why you're opposed to this bill.
I'm opposed to this bill because I have a USDA license, and I understand now that that won't be valid anymore, and that does far surpass the Oregon state law. I used to have an Oregon regulation, but I do a lot of education. What I do with my education is I teach people about monkeys. I teach them that they are difficult to take care of, that it's a 24/7 thing, they live up to 50 years, etc. I have talked many people out of getting them. However, responsible people like myself should be able to have them.
Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Oliver?
That's it.
Yes, my name is Harry Oliver. Okay. I come from a completely different perspective than everybody. I'm a 100% disabled veteran. I have the inability to bond with fellow people on a warm level due to my disability and the unique circumstances of my service in Vietnam for 2 years. It took a lot of medication to get me here today and be calm. Through my wife's interest in monkeys, which has spanned over 20 years, I have learned that although I still can bond with humans on a warm level, except interpersonal relationships with my family, these animals to me are as children. I take care of them as a father would take care of a child. I have never had a problem with the children. There is no possibility of our animals or most of the people that we know, which is fairly extensive, okay, of actually getting loose. There's too many security checks and bounds. We've devoted 600 square feet of living space for our animals to live in the winter, and we have a very, very extensive, and all of this is expensive. We also have a 22 by 24 foot total enclosure with double security, only entrance into the house, not out of the enclosure, except going into their home environment inside. My job really in the house is to take care of these monkeys. One of these monkeys is not an endangered monkey, but it is a threatened monkey. It's a very rare monkey. Our other monkey is also very rare, but of that I can't really speak too well. These monkeys, we don't intend to breed these monkeys, but my problem with all of these bills is as they seem to arise, and I've never had the guts to actually force myself to come to some kind of a meeting. I don't do well around meeting people. People don't take into account the fact that when you ban all these monkeys and you say that people have to get rid of them, because in effect we're boiling it all down to that. Okay, there is no place where I could send my monkeys if I had to because the law required it. Okay, where those monkeys would be in a situation where they would be able to act and ingratiate and and be nurtured by me and their needs being taken care of. They'd be relegated to the average, which is a 4x8-foot cage for a 40-pound animal.
Your time is up.
I'm sorry.
Thank you for your service, by the way, and you do very well.
Three of our monkeys were rescued, by the way, from very bad situations. They would have been killed otherwise. We didn't take them in. Thank you.
Okay, you sit right there. Bobby?
Madam Smith and representatives, my name is Buffy Brennan, and I am speaking in opposition to House Bill 3046 and on the behalf of the Tiger Preservation Center of Oregon. If this bill is passed, everything the Tiger Preservation family and her tigers have ever known and loved about Oregon will be gone. The Tiger Preservation Center has called Oregon its home for more than 15 years and planned on calling it home forever. Passing this bill, Oregon has a serious lack of will have a serious lack of up-close education. The Oregon public right now has access of up-close education of breeding, rarity, survival, and beauty. It would be a shame to take that all away from families, friends, education, admirers, and big cat lovers. Please take time to understand how important it is for these big cats to remain here in Oregon. Oregon is a beautiful state and deserves beautiful, rare, large cats to stay. Also, Oregon will be should be aware that breeding these cats is essential to survival. Survival means off the endangered species list and a natural right they were born to have. The Tiger Preservation Center realizes that natural means the means in the jungles of Asia, China, and the Sahara of Africa. But these are special, in essence, growing up in abuse, neglect, and unsanitary conditions that they will never understand or know natural habitat. The closest place they have to natural is the Tiger Preservation Center, with the surroundings of nature, trees, waterfall, and in their own pool to swim in. These large cats have a second chance of natural and survival by breeding. Importing and exporting these large cats is of extreme importance for survival and captivity. They are in need of a natural, secure place when they have been damaged by people in other places. And in need to belong somewhere, I personally could not think of a better place to send these animals and be proud as an Oregonian to have them share my state, my town, my home, my life, my love with these large cats, and to believe that there are other Oregonians who believe and stand behind the Tiger Preservation Center.
Thank you. Very much. Thank you. Molly Schaefer.
As the next panel comes up, can I just correct something for the record?
Can we do it at the end? Otherwise, I won't have time.
What?
If we don't do it at the end, I won't have time. Okay. I'm trying to get everyone. Molly Schaefer, Bill Cluding, and Marcia Keith. Yeah, maybe after the next panel. Go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm here opposing House Bill 3046 for a number of reasons. As a person who has dedicated the last 21 years of my life to breeding and caring for exotic animals, many of which are endangered species or rescue animals, I highly disagree with the suggestion that private individuals are not capable of properly caring for exotic animals. I have spent thousands of hours researching proper husbandry and disease control of these animals. I have over 500 books on natural history and propagation of exotic animals, which I have read from front to back. I've spent years learning from old-timers in this industry who have dedicated decades to this pursuit. My animals are healthy, happy, well-fed, and breed readily in captivity, a sign that I have met all of their requirements. My animals never have to worry about illness, attack, or where their next meal is coming from. I have more experience with captive husbandry of exotic animals than most zoo employees. It's a known fact that animals in captivity far outlive their wild counterparts. Unlike many zoo animals, my animals don't pace and exhibit neurotic behavior from being constantly exposed to screams and stares of the public. 2 years ago, you may recall reviewing a bill almost identical to this bill. At that time, the legislature decided that the bill was not worth acting on. In the 2 years since rejecting that bill, there have been no incidences of exotic animal attacks or public health concerns regarding exotic animals in Oregon. Yet here is an emergency bill being presented once again. I'm confused about what they think constitutes an emergency situation. Every 2 years, the animal rights radicals try to insinuate an emergency situation to try to ban private ownership of exotic animals in the state of Oregon. These people use false statistics and scare tactics to try to inflict their personal agenda on the people of this state. A number of years ago, after an incident of a man keeping a young tiger irresponsibly in a suburban neighborhood, the Oregon Department of Agriculture created new regulations concerning inherently dangerous animals, thus making it impossible for John Doe to legally keep a Class 3 animal. These regulations allowed for the responsible ownership of some of the smaller... Was that 2 minutes?
Yes. You were reading it, and we have it in writing, and I need you to state your name for the record.
Molly Schaefer.
I thought I did that. And we have it in writing, I think.
Okay. The only other comment I guess I had is that you're stating the animals can be grandfathered in. Grandfathering does not allow you to replace an animal once it's dead. Therefore, eventually, the animals would be completely banned.
Thank you. I think we're going to have Representative Hass clarify a few comments right after this panel. So
okay.
Thank you very much. Bill.
Thank you, Chair Smith. My story is about what can go wrong. One time, Oregon was world famous for black-tailed deer. Over 5 years ago, I managed 400 acres.
Louder.
For the record, my name is Bill Clooting.
He didn't hear me. Louder.
For the record, my name is Bill Clooting. I manage 400 acres in Polk County, ideal deer habitat. 5 years ago, I noticed a very odd behavior of hair loss, itching, biting, scratching of a large number of black-tailed deer. You ask questions, what's going on? And finally, I was told that, an exotic animal brought in some sort of a louse. And when we found out what this was, we found over 100 louse per square inch on these deer. And what happens, they're a bloodsucker, and they scratch and bite their hair off all winter. They lose their body heat. No matter what they eat, they're starving to death. And this is what's happened. Last night, for example, I went down, and where I should have seen 20 deer 5 years ago, I seen two small bucks, skinny, with half their hair missing. No does, no fawns. Baby fawns ought to be showing up now. They had to go to Asia to find out what this louse was. And it was identified as a exotic animal brought in from Asia. And now it is spread to our black-tailed deer. What's to keep it from going to the east side, to the mule deer, and our elk, and our domesticated animals, and humans? And by the way, this animal was brought into southwest Washington 10 years ago. And somehow it crossed a natural barrier of a river. And it is now spread down into Roseburg.
Your time is up.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you very much. And you're a supporter of the amendments. The bill.
Yes, I am a supporter.
Thank you. Well,
thank you. Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Marcia Keith, and I'm here today representing the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association in support of the Dastrey Amendments to House Bill 4036. Almost universally, veterinarians are opposed to the keeping of captive wild and exotic animals. While such animals may have a personal appeal to an individual, ignorance of behavioral traits, proper nutrition, social needs of these animals often leads to inadvertent abuse. Furthermore, humans exposed to these kinds of animals may suffer from transmissible diseases also. The intent of this legislation is consistent with position statements that have been formulated a long time ago by both the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association and its parent, the American Veterinary Medical Association. So we ask you and encourage your support of this bill.
Thank you very much. Representative Hass, did you want to clarify a few?
Very quickly, I there were a couple of things. Are we done?
No, I've got another page, or half a page. Five people signed up.
Let's do it at the end.
Okay. Thank you very much. Lisa and Roger, do you want to come up together? And Randy Tucker? And I think you know how this works. Welcome.
Good morning.
For the record, I'm Lisa Hansen, Assistant Director with the Department of Agriculture, and I brought with me Roger Huffman, the Administrator of our Animal Health and ID Program that has oversight for the current law regulating the captivity of exotic animals. I just want to give you just a brief bit of background of around the current law. The law was passed in 1999 after extensive work with the department and a broad representation of stakeholders. Currently in Oregon, there are about 90 state permitted animals and about 4,000 federally permitted animals. The federal law and current state law allow people to possess crocodiles. This bill would require a state permit for those who are in possession of animals of the crocodile family in Oregon, and that would be an inconsistency with what is currently in the federal regulations. Another point that we've talked about a little bit within the Department of Agriculture, if the intent of the changes in the law are to protect people from dangerous animals, should there be consideration for other species such as poisonous dangerous snakes? And finally, with the discussions of wolves coming back into Oregon, should there be some distinction between indigenous wolves and other types of wolves? So those were just some of the issues that the department wanted to bring to the committee. And with that, if you have any specific questions, I believe Roger could answer those. Roger, do you have anything else you want to add?
Madam Chair, I would be just available for questions.
All right. Randy Tucker.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Randy Tucker, Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro, the regional government of the Portland metropolitan area. And while you usually, if you see me at all, see me in the context of talking about land use and transportation, we also own and operate several regional facilities in the Portland area, including the Oregon Zoo. And this is the first time I've had the opportunity to testify on behalf of the zoo. And let me just say that I thought land use was confusing and contentious, but I didn't know about these issues before. I'm actually testifying on behalf of our zoo director, Tony Vecchio, who wanted to be here to testify today, and certainly if you have any questions for him, I'd be glad to relay them to him. He had a conflict and couldn't make it. We're testifying in support of House Bill 3046, and I'd like to just make a couple of very brief points. First of all, as you've heard, exotic animals require the care of trained professionals for the welfare of the animal and for the safety of the public. The American Zoo Association has rigorous guidelines for what it takes to be a professional zoo, and we at the zoo have highly educated, highly trained professional staff. Most of them have degrees in wildlife biology or zoology or a similar degree, and it's important. Second, the zoo gets calls all the time from people who can't handle their pets anymore. They were told when they obtained these pets in many cases that if the tiger or the snake or the crocodile gets too big or if the monkey gets too aggressive, that the zoo will take it. The zoo can't take it. All the zoo's animals are there as part of a very elaborate and well thought out breeding programs, and we just can't take animals that come in from people that have pets and can't handle them anymore. If someone gets tired of the tiger is likely to be the loser ultimately in the end. So I'm finished, Madam Chair.
You're good.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Uncharacteristically brief. I'll take that last 3 seconds.
Uncharacteristically. I love it. Representative Burley?
No.
Thank you very much. No, I'm not. Kat Mills? And no, SDK is not 100 miles.
Boy, it sure did seem like it when I was driving 2 hours to get here.
Sure, I drive it a lot.
Well, I'm a little unfamiliar with
this. That's okay. Thank you.
My name's Kat Mills.
Yes.
And I'm from SDK, obviously. I have something to
hand out
and give to you all. I'm not going to read from it. I'm just because you guys can read just as well as I can.
You got it.
At least I hope so. But I bet you can count better than me. I have the proposed amendments in front of me. I just want to read from a couple of notes. Repeatedly, I've heard people come up here and say that private owners are uneducated and that we need to educate them, and therefore, let's ban them. This is very, very illogical. In 2003, the Humane Society of the United States issued on their website 23 different incidents regarding just tigers. Of those 23 incidents, 21 of them were from sanctuaries, not private owners. We don't have a private owner problem. This is not a state of emergency in Oregon. And by the way, I need to preface this. I am not an exotic owner. I just have dogs. And I am absolutely appalled at this kind of lawmaking. Oregon has the most common sense legislative body regarding the ownership and care of proper regulation of exotic animals, and I cannot understand why we want to put another rash of punitive laws that is going to cost the private owners a lot of more money than is necessary. I believe that many people are misinformed regarding exotic ownership and domesticity. I also sent to each of your representatives here a email packet called the Oregon Law, which was a packet that I wrote that pointed out what the Humane Society of the United States and the American the Animal Protection Institute, these are out-of-state organizations that have publicly stated that their intent and goal is to eliminate all private animal use. That includes agribusiness, all animal use at all. This bill in particular has been sponsored by API and the Humane Society of the United States, both of which we saw as representative here. These people do not want anybody to own or use animals, period. This is the step one in Oregon to change the law the way we've had it, the way it works. Exotic owners and animal owners have kept up our end of the bargain, and this law is not, it's just not good for us.
Thank you.
And I'm nervous as all get out, and I believe I've just talked it out.
Your time is up. Perfect. Thank you very much. Paul Snyder,
thank you very much.
Called him, but I didn't see him here. He probably left. I had one other lady signed up, and I have about 2 minutes. Jean Hall. She wanted to testify. Hi.
Yeah. Hi.
The lady with the cell phone. Keith, I'm not watching up here.
I thought I turned it off. I turned it on.
Thank you. For your record, you need to state your name.
Okay.
Okay, my name is Jeannie Hall, and I am the president of the Phoenix Exotic Wildlife Association, but I'm here simply as an exotic owner. I'd like to represent the owners that cannot be here. When you have the sponsors of the bill, Animal Protection Institute, HSUS, they are paid lobbyists, paid staff. Your constituents are out there working, they have jobs, they have kids, they can't get here on this short notice. But there are a lot of them. We have a lot of PhDs, we have vets. Vets do take care of our animals. We don't have these animals out there uncared for. Okay? I'm trying to cut this down. When you're told about abuse and problems and that exist in the exotic community, those problems do exist. I'd like to acknowledge that. But they exist with domestics, they exist with children, and they exist with women. The same people that are causing harm or doing things illegally and responsibly are doing things in that area. Address abuse, address illegal acts, and address criminality. Exotics just happen to also be there. We have many responsible owners. And if you would stop this bill completely and have a study, allow some of those in favor who are responsible owners and who can address these issues to address you and not just hear from the guys who want to ban everything, you could see both sides. We do exist. We are out there. Molly is one that has a lot of data, but there are thousands here in Oregon, and those are your constituents, not the API paid staff. That's all I had to say.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's everybody I have signed up. Representative Hass, did you want to say anything?
No, I just want to thank everybody who came forward and testified either against this bill or in support of it. And but there are a couple of factual errors that I just want to clarify for the record. First of all, most of the people testifying in opposition to this bill have a USDA license and therefore are exempt. This wouldn't affect you. Many of you who have these pets now are protected by the grandfather clause in this bill and would not be affected. There is an exemption statute that exists in current law that will not change under this bill for wildlife rehabilitation centers or other facilities. Those laws won't change. And to the veteran here who came, and I didn't write down his name, there is an exemption for certain monkeys that are sometimes referred to as helper monkeys under the American Disabilities Act. And I'm not sure if that's, it's not classified as that. Okay.
We can't allow testimony
okay.
from the.
Well, there is an exemption for some of these in other parts of the law. And as far as costing more, this bill won't cost any more. There's no fiscal impact here. If anything, ultimately, this will cost taxpayers less. And, you know, finally, I think one woman said that one of the people who testified said these people just don't want anybody to own animals. I own dogs, cats, fish, snails, hermit crabs, and I have a daughter that has a mini jungle in her bedroom, and I love animals, and that's one of the driving forces for me in support of something to stop the irresponsible actions with regards to some of these animals. You've heard from veterinarians and law enforcement who see this problem every single day, and maybe they don't see it from you, but they deal with this problem every day.
Thank you very much. And thank you to all of you who came and testified. I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3046, and we are adjourned.